This is the Game Misconduct Podcast with Don LaGreca.
And welcome to the Monday edition of Game Misconduct. I'm Don LaGreca. Monday usually means EJ Raddick from NHL Now on the NHL Network from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. EJ, how are you?
I'm good. How's everything going with you, buddy?
Doing well. Having some fun watching these conference final and, maybe a little disappointed in the Hurricanes. I thought they were in good shape through the first two periods of game one. They had a 2-1 lead going into the third period. So you can look at the Bruins being up 2-0 and say, all right, well, there's no hope. It's over. But, you know, the six periods have been played. I thought the Hurricanes clearly won the first two and could have very easily won the game if not for those penalties in the third period. So, I mean, how do you assess so far the first two games out east?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, Carolina's special teams are killing them.
Yeah,
I mean their penalty killing has been terrible. I think the Bruins have scored four power play goals in their last five opportunities. Carolina's not getting anything done on the power play, so you know 5-on-5 they've been okay, but you know in the game there wasn't a lot generated yesterday to begin with. I mean it was 41 shot attempts for Carolina, 38 shot attempts in the game for the Bruins. So. You know, the Carolina special teams on the road this year in particular have been really bad. And they haven't been much better at home either. But they got to hope this is going to be like the situation that they had against the Washington Capitals where right. They lost the first two games and Washington came back home and won. Now, in those games, you got to remember, one of the games went to overtime. So, you know, it seemed like they were more in the game at that stage. We'll have to see now what they do with the goaltending, but certainly they got an uphill fight now.
I guess that's the question. I agree with what Brenda Moore did, but I guess looking back now, should he have stuck with McElhaney?
Well, it's easy to say now that they've
right.
won two games that, you know, he should have stuck with him. I mean, I think I had no problem with him
no.
going back to Mrazek if that's you know, Rod all year long, I mean, I've talked to him a couple times during the season, you know, for our show, and he's been someone that delegates, and Mike Bales is the goaltending coach there, and he really delegates those decisions about, you know, where the goalies are and who's going to play to the goaltending coach. And so the last half of the year, Mrazek was their guy, particularly down the stretch. He had great numbers. When he got hurt, he had been playing well. They had time where he was 100%, so they started him. I had no issue with that. You know, even the game yesterday, there was a lot of discussion on the broadcast of taking him out, which, you know, I might have done, but Brendan Moore has not changed his goaltender for other than for injury all season long. So he's not been a big guy to pull a goaltender. So I think that you want to stay true to who you are in the playoffs, and I think that's why he left him in. Now, that all gets us now to game three. What's going to happen next. And I think, again, that is now a more interesting debate because the Bruins have handled Mrazek pretty good. Maybe he goes to McElhaney. But on the flip side, when they were losing 2-0 to the Washington Capitals, Peter Mrazek was the guy in game three. So I guess that'll be interesting fodder for conversation between now and puck drop tomorrow night when they get ready for game three in Carolina.
All right, now we've got game two tonight, San Jose. Sharks up 1-0 on the Blues after a thorough thrashing of the Blues 6-3. Had a 5-2 lead going into the third period, and Pavelski, he's looked good with big goals in the two games in which he's returned. And really, how great was Timo Meier on Saturday?
Oh, yeah, he's our worst, that kid. I mean, he was a ninth overall draft pick in his draft year a couple of years back, and he's just a really good player, you know, and he's been getting better and better. He started to come on the radar for me, Donnie, like last year.
Mm-hmm.
I started to watch, you know, because I watch a lot of the West Coast games. I'm kind of a night owl. I work till 6. I have a long drive home. By the time I get home and dealing with kids, I don't see the East as much. People think I see the East more. I probably see the West more because I'm settled in by that time of the day and I can really focus on the games more. And so he was a guy that really stood out to me last season as a guy that was really becoming more of a factor. And you can see, you know, so far this season, you know, he's had a really good year and his playoffs have been really good. You know, the other night in less than 15 minutes of the game, right, he had two goals and assists. He's a plus player. He had 7 shot opportunities. He had 5 hits, even won a faceoff. I mean, he's doing just about everything. So when you look at Meyer and you look at Tomas Hertl, those two young guys have really, you know, they've really stepped up to add to that mix of that older group of forwards there. They have like Pavelski and Thornton, and to a lesser degree, Evander Kane, who's still a pretty young guy. And so their top six group is really strong where all those guys are healthy and going. And Meyer is going to be a good player for a long time.
All right, what do you do about Tarasenko for St. Louis, right? One even-strength point in the series against Dallas. He did have an even-strength assist in the loss in Game 1, but really has not been seen as far as a dominant player since the Jet series. So how do the Blues get him going? And can they survive if he doesn't?
Well, I mean, that's a great, you know, you say it. How do they get him going? I mean, they can move him around lines. I mean, I think you got to play him.
Of course.
I don't think. But sometimes guys say, well, you're going to sit him or you're going to move him to a fourth line or something. I don't think that's the answer. I just think they have to, you know, they have to get him going. Who knows if he's dealing with something. Sometimes it's just, you know, it's just really hard to play in the postseason. I mean, everybody knows that Vladimir Tarasenko is a really good player. And so there's a lot of attention paid to him. I mean, the other night on the Meyer goal, when Parayko was coming up the right side, the one thing I noticed is Tarasenko was on that side, but he wasn't really moving his feet. And basically, he was in the way of Parayko more than anything else. And then Parayko got his pocket picked kind of by Couture. It went to Meyer, and he made that great play, and he scored. But I guess the thing to impart to Vladimir Tarasenko is you got to get your feet moving more. And, you know, when you have the puck, take the puck to the net, try to shoot the puck as much as you can, and you know, that's about it. I mean, so he's an important piece of that team. It wasn't a good night for him the other night. It wasn't a really good night for a lot of the Blues. Alex Petrangelo wasn't very good. Jay Boumeister wasn't very good. You know, Joel Edmondson wasn't very good. I mean, there was a number of guys who struggled in that game for the St. Louis Blues. So they got to be better. The thing I think that they have to I think they've got to try not to focus on, like the other night, it just seemed like they were trying to hit everything that moved, and they were trying to really like set the tempo by delivering all these big hits. I think they got to be a little bit smarter against the San Jose Sharks. I think that Eric Carlson said it best. They asked him about the physical play, and he's like, well, guys have been doing this to me in this league for 11 years. So I don't know if you're going to rattle a Carlson or a Burns with physical play. Maybe you have to take a more strategic approach to how you try to get under those guys defensively. So that will be something I'll be looking for tonight if the Blues do try some different tactics in dealing with, you know, those high-end defensemen for the Sharks.
I just wonder this, too, because I worked Game 1, Bruins Hurricanes for Westwood 1, and my second intermission guest.
I heard you.
Oh, you did? Oh, thank you, Bernie.
I heard you.
Thanks for taking the time.
Happy to hear you. Well, listen, I was driving, and I heard you, and I was like, oh, it's good to hear Donnie up here.
So I don't know if you heard this, but I had Brett Hedekin as my second intermission guest to preview the Western Conference, and I asked him straight out, are you concerned about, you know, 14 games played, three overtime games, one of which went to double overtime, having to come back from 3-1 down against Vegas, some older players, banged up players too. And he said he was very concerned about that. So I'm just wondering if the St. Louis Blues thought, hey, you know, this team's probably beat up. Let's beat them up some more. Like, you know, we're in this for the long haul here. So what maybe did not work in game one, maybe they're banking on that kind of play is going to hurt them later in the series.
Well, you know, that's the old story, right? You know, try to tenderize the opponent
right,
with the physical play early. And, you know, that's a great strategy is if you can get to a game seven. But if that strategy is not working and you're eliminated in 4 or 5,
right,
I guess it doesn't much matter, right? So I think that, again, I think that, you know, St. Louis, to me, they got to do one thing better for sure is to stop turning the puck over in the neutral zone and be better in their own end. And they've got to clean that up. I mean, there was 3 or 4 plays that led directly to goals for the San Jose Sharks, so they absolutely have to clean that up. I just think they have to be more strategic with their approach to dealing with Carlson and Burns, and you know, I'll be curious to see if they do change that strategy tonight. But you know, I could see certainly Brett Hedekin is around the Sharks a lot. He works for the team. He's on the broadcasts, and you know, yeah, you got Joe Thornton. You know, who's long on the tooth. You got Joe Pavelski, who's been dinged up. You got Carlson, who has had injury issues all year long. I mean, yeah, there's some concern, but, you know, let's face it, teams that go on to win the Stanley Cup, they usually don't have an easy ride, and
no,
they usually have to battle through a lot of things. So, you know, this Sharks team, it's not too far removed from a trip to the final a couple of years ago. They've been knocking at the door for a long time. They're a lot like the Capitals were last year. And so, You know, I just think that you always have to take a smart approach to your opponent. So we'll see what the Blues do tonight and if they try anything a little different.
No, you just brought up a great point that we've kind of reiterated during the course of our conversations this year of the similarities between the Sharks and the Capitals, right? Teams that you just changed over of the period of time. The Sharks looked like a team that could be beat, that could win the cup early, and then what's wrong with the San Jose Sharks? And then they got hot, and then what's wrong with the San Jose Sharks? And next thing you know, they win the cup. The Capitals were kind of the same way. You know, once they got past Pittsburgh, it seemed like they were kind of got things going, but then they fell behind 3-2 to Tampa and had to come back and win games 6 and 7. So there are similarities where, you know, just when you think the Sharks got it figured out, they dip and then they come back, and maybe this will be Caps 2.0 with the Sharks team.
Yeah, you know, the other thing about the Capitals, too, is, like, you know, I think a key guy for that team was Kuznetsov, and he's somebody that was a more recent addition to that group. And, you know, he has been a key guy for them. And then San Jose, in their case, you know, Meyer and Hurdle are more recent acquisitions, and they may be more important to that group now, probably they are, than certainly like a guy like Thornton and maybe even a Pavelski at this point in terms of driving play from a shift-to-shift basis. So, you know, it's an interesting comparison. We'll see how things go. I mean, game two, obviously, the Sharks have been good at winning games one at home in the first two rounds. They've lost game two in each of the last two rounds, and obviously St. Louis has been a good road team, so I would expect a big pushback from the Blues tonight.
I saw our friend Steve Mears tweet this out. I guess it was earlier last week. Maybe you saw the tweet just about where all of these regular season goaltenders ranked. And it wasn't great. Now, none of the four goaltenders that are in the final four were considered to have amazing seasons. And if you look at the round before, you know, this was not Bobrovsky's great regular season, and certainly he was much better in the postseason. There isn't anybody that you'd say quote-unquote elite. None of these goaltenders have won a Stanley Cup as the starter. I realize so do you need an elite goaltender anymore? If you've got the right pieces in place, EJ, when you're talking about a salary cap sport now, is it important to have a large percentage of that cap invested in what is considered a quote-unquote elite goaltender? Or would you rather have that money spent elsewhere and have a good goaltender that you can just hope can be great in the playoffs?
Well, I mean, last year, Braden Holtby won the Cup, right? He's a pretty darn good goalie, and he's the guy that plays most of the games for them. I think nowadays, guys are playing fewer games, right? Like, that's the new thing, is, like, you don't want to burn somebody out. Like, Fleury last year, because of injuries, played less than 50 games, and the same thing with Braden Holtby. He played fewer games than he had ever played before intentionally, because, and then he had some struggles, and they started to play Grubauer more. So I think we're seeing teams opt for, you know, to have the more willingness to play two goalies and to opt to have their starters play less. So in that circumstance, I mean, you know, to pay a guy, you know, the $8, $9 million to play, you know, 45 games is tricky, right? So, I mean, it's certainly something that the people who deal with the cap on each of these individual teams have to worry about. Now, that said, if you have Carey Price, you're really happy you have him. If you have Henrik Lundqvist, you're probably really happy you have him. You know, Ben Bishop played fewer games this year, in part by design and in part because of injury. So I think it's a team-to-team basis how these things unfold. But I do think that the metric is going to continue to push for guys to play less games. I don't think the ideal situation is for goalies to play 65 games anymore. I think the ideal number is more like 55 games now, which means that you're going to have to invest more in your backup to have a better one. I mean, like, Boston went out and got Yaro Halak this year, and I think that really helped Tuukka Rask a lot. And Tuukka Rask is playing great hockey right now. He's playing as well as I've ever seen him play. Anton Hudobin in Dallas was a really big addition for that team. So I think teams are, you know, having to kind of look at their goaltending situation and figure out, you know, what they want to spend on the position. And they need to have a reliable number two. In Toronto, that was a big issue this year with Mike Babcock not really having faith in Garrett Sparks and being really disappointed that they lost Curtis McElhinney, who went on to Carolina and did very well.
No, it's a great point because you brought up last year too. When you look at the goaltenders, you know, it's Fleury versus Holpe. Those are two elite goaltenders. This year it might be, you know, Binnington, going up against, Mrazek, / yeah. McElhaney. You know, so,
I think it's the number, Donnie. It's the number of games that people are looking at because, like you just mentioned, Fleury and Holpe, really high end goalies last year.
Right.
But neither one of them played the amount of games that they've played in the past
in
a single season. And I think that's what teams are looking at. What's the ideal number to keep our goalie fresh for the postseason run?
And however, the, you know, kind of looking at pitchers in baseball right now, baseball doesn't have a cap, but you look at pitchers. A pitcher, the guy's going to make 30 starts out of your 162 games. Look at the money that pitchers are still commanding. Even if I'm only going to play you 55, 60 games, if you're really good, you still may command a lot of money, if not max money.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you're going to win, if you're going to win 35 of those 55 starts and you've got a serviceable backup that can win another 10, 15, you're going to be a team that's going to be a home ice advantage in the playoffs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, and the other thing, too, though, to realize, you know, again, because it is a cap circumstance in hockey is that, you know, you got to have a good team in front of the guys that are in goal. So, I mean, you could have a great goalie. I mean, you saw the Rangers have Henrik Lundqvist this year. Now, I know he's later in his career, but, you know, they're rebuilding. So, you know, they had a run early in the year when they played pretty well, and Henrik Lundqvist was a part of that. But at the end of the day, if you don't have the players in front of these guys, it's hard to win.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's hand in hand. You need your goaltender to play well, but you need to have structure, and you need to have, like we've talked about in the past, it's like, you know, to me, those two centers – you know, your two centers, your 4D, and your goalie is kind of the spine of your team. And then everything else you build around that.
You ready for some tweets?
I am ready for some tweets.
You probably saw this coming. You probably got a lot of this already since the the World Championships are happening in Europe.
Yes.
So far, Capo Caco has lit it up in the IIHF. This is according to Sam Diaz. Do you think that it will be him and not Hughes picked first overall?
Well, I mean, the Devils have the pick, right? So the Devils are going to pick who they think is the best player. They're the ones who choose, right? I mean, if there was someone else picking, they might choose somebody else. You know, it just depends, you know, who's picking. I think the Devils like Hughes. They're getting a good look at him right now with their head coach, John Hines, on the bench for Team USA with Jack Hughes there. I don't know if I was the Hughes camp, if I would have played in this tournament. I don't know if I saw the upside for him to play in this tournament. He just played in the under-18s. He's played a lot of hockey this year, and now he's jumped in here at the World Championships. But, you know, they're comfortable with it. They've decided to do it. You know, Caco has gotten off to a great start here, and he's had the goals, five goals, two of them empty netters, but still there was a highlight reel goal that he scored. I do not see these players enough to make a personal judgment on it. I trust the people that I know, you know, Craig Button, for example. You know, Craig and I are friends, and Craig works for TSN, and this is what he does at TSN. He follows these guys around, and he's of the mind that Jack Hughes is the guy.
Right.
And I tend to believe him, and I think centers I always like more than wingers, and Jack is a center, and Caco is a winger, and so that's a factor for me. But you know, the problem with what's going to happen now in the next couple of weeks is people are going to watch this tournament and they're going to make judgments based on the snapshot of how they play in this particular tournament. So, I mean, that's what's going to happen. And at the end of the day, the Devils will make the pick. I think the Devils are going to take Hughes, but, you know, until they get up there and say the guy's name, we don't know.
Well, you go by their social media, every time Hughes, you know, scratches himself, they tweet about it. So it seems to me like that's the guy.
But
I don't know.
But they also tweet about the other guy.
Yeah.
I mean, they tweeted about him scoring the other day, and they also tweeted about both of them today playing against each other head-to-head.
Okay.
Again, Team USA ended up winning in overtime 3-2, and I don't believe either guy really had a big impact in the game. So both are really talented young players. I like the size of Caco. He's got great size. He reminds me a little bit of Rantanen, you know, maybe because he's another Finn, big, strong guy that's going to have a really good career in this league. And, you know, as for Jack Hughes, I feel the same way. Jack Hughes is really a crafty player and smart and great edge work, and is going to be a really high-end player for a long time. So both of them are going to be really good. It's just a matter of, I guess, who we feel is going to be better in the long term. And as I told you earlier, I always favor centers over.
Yeah, you've always said that for sure. This is the second time the Devils are in this situation against a divisional opponent. The first time was when they went with Heischer over Patrick. And so far, you know, the jury's out. And this will be the same thing with the Rangers and the Devils. Who got it right? Because whoever didn't get it right is going to have to live with the mistake in their own division for possibly the next decade and a half.
That's right. Exactly. And, you know, the interesting thing about going back to Nico and Nolan, right, and the Devils took Heischer, and I was on board with that. I liked Heischer better than Patrick. But the funny thing is that the kids that went 3, 4, and 5 were fellows by the name of Miro Heiskanen, Cale Makar, and Elias Pettersson. And, you know, I think that those three guys, all of them, they all have a chance maybe to be better than the first two picks.
That'd be
and
something.
I think if I was picking to start right now, again, based on what I know today, I would probably pick Heiskanen because I just think he's an unbelievable difference maker on defense. So, I mean, but again, that's the beauty of hindsight, and that's why it's really hard for these guys, the amateur scouts, even at the very highest level. You know, with the guys they watch the most, it's a very, you know, it's not a perfect science to be picking players at 17 years of age, you know, 17, 18 years of age.
Now, this is a tough one because it's apples and oranges, but Forever TH says, with Kawhi Leonard hitting the clutch game winner last night, my question is, what was the most memorable clutch goal you've ever seen in NHL playoff history?
Wow. Well, I mean, for me, that I saw in person was Bobby Nystrom scoring at 7-11 of overtime on May 24th, 1980. So that was a pretty good one, that I saw in person. I mean, Mike Ruzioni scoring for Team USA against Russia 10 minutes left in the third period was a pretty big one at that time. It's funny, both those plays happened within like 3 or 4 months of each other. So it's kind of funny that they'd be so fresh in my mind. But, you know, Patrick Kane scoring the overtime game winner in game 6, I guess, Philly in 2010. We were both there in the building for that one, I can remember. And,
the goal that no one saw.
Yeah, that's right. Nobody saw it winning except Kane and one or two other people in the building. But, you know, goals that are scored to win. You know, the other night, Patrick Maroon, just for a more recent example, scoring a double overtime game 7 to move you on to the next round.
That's huge.
That's a big-time goal, right? So, I mean, it's different in basketball where, you know, you hit a shot as the – you know, because the score changes a lot more in basketball. Obviously, they score hundreds of points in games, you know. So it's different than hockey. But those overtime game winners, particularly, in clinching games. I mean, we had Justin Williams, Mr. Game 7, was involved in that one that was scored by Brock McGinn against the Caps in double overtime of Game 7. Barkley Gaudreau had an overtime goal in Game 7 against the Vegas Golden Knights. So those are all goals that come to mind for me right away.
Yeah, those are true. And, you know, Mateau with the Rangers in 94.
Yeah, that's a great one.
For me, it wasn't, you know, in overtime, but it was very late in Game 7 in 2000, Patrick Eliash's goal against the Flyers. If you remember, I think it was like a minute and a half to go. In the third period of that one, so there was still some time for the Flyers to answer, but and this isn't NHL playoffs, and this certainly isn't a Game 7, but it was a championship game as the golden goal by Sidney Crosby. When you consider the pressure on him and representing Canada and how, you know, so that would kind of sit for me is one of the biggest goals ever.
Yeah, no question.
Let's see.
There's a lot of them over the years.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to compare it to basketball because basketball, you know, you're always setting up for the last shot, right? You know, if you're getting a tight game, I mean, it's there's a lot of lead changes. Lead could change 4 times in the last, 30 seconds of a basketball game.
Chris asks, is the lack of a policeman in today's NHL the reason why Brad Marchand continues with his antics?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, the game has changed, right? So, but we had Ken Linsman back in the 80s as someone that was known as the Rat. I mean, I think that's who I got to meet later on, and I really enjoyed my time talking to him. And, you know, like Brad Marchand, Ken Linsman was a really good player. I mean, Ken Linsman averaged more than a point per game in the playoffs in his career, and he was almost a point per game player over 800 games in an NHL career. So, at that time, he was still doing the things he does, and there was all kinds of tough guys running around. So I always think it's on the players. I mean, you know, to take care of business if they feel something needs to be taken care of, and then for the team to kill the penalty if someone takes one in that situation. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm maybe I'm old school in that way, but I think you have to take care of business, and your team has to respond accordingly to kill penalties if you take them in those kind of situations. So I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer to that question, but I do know that Ken Linsman did it in that era, and there were other players like him that irritated. Dale Hunter was the guy that irritated, and like it still went on. So
that's the
I think that's it's probably part of hockey in some ways. Guys like to get under your skin. They think that they're getting some kind of advantage, and they do it. You know, it's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, so it's not going to change, and maybe it's incumbent on the league to be stronger for those incidents that took place, like the, you know, punching Anderson in the back of the head, the stomping on the stick of Cam Atkinson. You know, if he gets a 2-minute minor for that or gets suspended a game for punching Anderson, you know, then maybe that would quiet it down. But I think it's good for the game. I think you need people to hate. I think that makes it fun to get into. Yeah, I'm sure there's people that maybe, you know, that wouldn't necessarily be watching this series, but because of their hatred for him, become Hurricane fans and watch. I mean, it's not that I'm encouraging it, but it's hard to say it's bad for the league.
I mean, look at Sean Avery. I mean, there's a guy that, you know, there were people, I know, Ranger fans to this day that love Sean Avery. And there's you know, a lot of other fans that can't stand him. So, I mean, you know, and
The problem with Sean was he seemed to tick off his own teammates and team as much as he did the rest of the league. That's what really that's what hurt Sean.
Occasionally he did do that as well. And, you know, I mean, he's still out there. I guess they're harassing people on the street now. I don't even know what's going on with him. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, there's sports, you know, sometimes you have the guys who wear the white hat and the guys who wear the dark hat, right? And that's all part of the entertainment and the drama of sports. And, you know, I think you see it in the different sports. And, you know, these are guys that have been able to make great careers. I mean, at the end of the day, Brad Marchand is a great player, but he does do things that you just shake your head at sometimes because they're just, you know, inconsequential. At least I feel some of them are inconsequential to the results, but he must feel that, you know, these things have a place for him in helping him either get himself to another level emotionally in the game, or maybe to bring his team into the game more emotionally.
That happens. And ask yourself this question: as much as you hate all the players hated all the players that EJ just listed, would you want them on your team? And the answer 90% of the time would be yes. So that's the thing. Let's close it out with Finsanity, who says, Don and EJ, what do you think of going back to the 1-8 seed format, but without reshuffling after the first round? This would prevent some unfair first round matchups and still support Bracket Challenge. Love the show, especially Mondays.
Thank you. I don't know. I don't like the bracket, to be honest.
No, I don't either.
I think it's a gimmick that was done, you know, because of the success of the NCAA bracket and to try to create this bracket challenge. And that's all nice. It's all marketing. It's nice. But at the end of the day, it's really not fair. You know, I like the reseed where if there is an upset, then, you know, the teams, you know, there is benefit to having finished with a good record in the regular season. You know, the Boston Bruins, you know, for example, have had to go through, you know, the Toronto Maple Leafs and the Columbus Blue Jackets. They would have had the Tampa Bay Lightning if they would have won. I mean, I liked it better when it was one versus, you know, 1-8, 2-7, and then the winners, you know, reseeded after that. It gave a little bit more credence to the finish points-wise in the regular season. I don't have a huge problem with the way they do it now. I don't sit up at night, you know, howling at the moon over it. But I am, I do prefer it the way they did it before. And, you know, over my lifetime and yours, Don, we've seen the playoff format change a number of times. So we will see how things unfold in the coming years. But, you know, if I could change that, probably I would.
Yeah, I would too. I don't know how lucrative the bracket challenge is as far as getting more eyeballs to their website, getting more eyeballs to watch the games. I do know everybody has that NCAA bracket envy, but you know, if you wanted to go that far, I've thought about this, EJ. You want to create interest? You want to get a buzz like college basketball does? First day of the playoffs, everyone plays. Yeah. Have games in the afternoon. Just have like a marathon of games. Start games at noon, go straight up until midnight. Just the first day, get everybody buzzed, get everybody engaged, and then everybody can kind of just disperse after that first day and do what they want to do. If you really wanted to create interest, I've thought about that. I know the shortest straw would go to the team having to play at noon, and that would probably be bad for their ratings and maybe for their attendance, but I just think overall, how exciting would that be? Just a full day, games wall to wall.
Open the NHL playoffs with that full day of games. I like it. I've heard that. I think Greg Wyszynski had a similar idea to that. You know, over the years. But I like it. I think it would be kind of fun to do something like that. It would create a frenzy for hockey fans for the whole day to be watching games. And let's face it, people go to the games now. It doesn't matter what time it is. I mean, they find if there's a game during the week, they get off and they go to the game. That's it. I mean, it's like. So I don't think it's an awful thing for one day of the year.
If you were strategic enough to make sure that it was a team that you know draws, like if it was like the Rangers or the Flyers or, you know, a team that you knew it wouldn't be an issue, then I think you can. Again, it's just a one day. Right? If you wanted to do it like Thursday, Friday, like they do at the NCAA tournament, like you'll have four games on Thursday and four games on Friday, and it'll beginning at noon, and then you have three, and then you have six, and then you have nine, or something like that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it'd be awesome.
Yeah, I think that would do more for the sport than having a, you know, a bracket challenge. That, quite frankly, especially this year, everybody's bracket got busted in the first day, first round, and it probably people forgot about it. I know I did. I don't look at my Brunson. Once Tampa was gone, I'm like, forget it. You know, I'm not going to bother.
And the only guy that's really done well in the bracket thing is the governor of North Carolina.
Right.
Like this Roy Cooper, I believe, is the governor of North Carolina, and because of he's in Carolina, he had the Canes going to the final against the San Jose.
There you go.
You know, he was looking good until this last weekend.
Yeah, he wasn't going to pick against his team, you know, so that's great. So
Meanwhile, as we're speaking here, and I know you're going to run this later, but I'm watching Slovakia and Canada in a physical tilt. Mm-hmm. As Slovakia has taken an early 2-0 lead, and Canada is now mixing it up physically to try to get in the game. So usually you don't see this kind of stuff at the World Championships, but there's gloves and sticks all over the place. So
all right, well, I'm sure people listening already know the result of that. But
that's right. So we'll see if Canada, when you hear this, if Canada has come back and
see
won,
it work.
You'll know they had to rally and get involved physically in the game. So anyway.
All right, so we got one game tonight. That is game two of the Western Conference Final between the Sharks and the Blues. 9 o'clock will be the start of that one. I will be on the Westwood One pre and post beginning at 8:45.
So that. I'll be listening.
SiriusXM 91. Check it out online.
Practice.
All right, excellent.
My son's practice tonight, so after practice I'll be driving. I'm sure I'll hear you in between periods.
All right, so I will talk to you next Monday.
You got it, buddy.
All right, man. Take care.
All right, see ya.
All right, that's the great EJ Raddick. Joins us every single Monday. Back with you again tomorrow. This was the Monday edition of Game Misconduct.
Thanks for listening to the Game Misconduct Podcast. Looking for more Don LaGreca? Hear him on the Michael K. Show weekdays from 3 to 7 p.m. on 98.7 ESPN in New York. And worldwide on the ESPN app. And don't forget to subscribe to the Game Misconduct Podcast on the ESPN app, Google Play Music, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.